David, you know, if I would go back and preach 1 Samuel again, I would probably do 21 and 22 together. It's a, it was kind of an unfortunate break. I went for it anyway. The story of David, here in chapter 22, especially starting in verse 6, really does tie back into the events that took place in Nob the chapter before. So quick recap to make sure we all are on the same page. In chapter 21, David's on the run. He finally realized, and so did Jonathan, that he couldn't stay in the palace anymore. Saul's walking around. He's got a spear in his hands. Like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The dude is crazy, and it's time for me to go. And Jonathan, his best friend, realizes as well, says, yeah, you better get out of town and leave. So he heads off to a place called Nob, and he goes to meet with one of the priests, Ahimelech, and Ahimelech the priest. And we see an unfortunate side of David, that he acts not so David-ish. He acts like he needs to take matters into his own hands. He needs to make sure that he takes care of himself instead of just trusting in what God's provisions are. And so he ends up lying to Ahimelech and saying that he's on a secret mission from the king, and he just needs some food. And if there's any weapons around, that would be great. He does get some food, and then he does get Goliath's sword. And we get introduced to a guy, verse 7, a guy by the name of Doeg, the Edomite, who happened to be detained before the Lord, whatever that means, we're not too sure, but Doeg gets introduced, but then David takes off from there, heads into Philistine territory, and acts like a crazy man. Did you guys like my crazy man impersonation last week? That was, I thought that was pretty good impersonation myself. I'm still waiting. Did anyone go online and try and search for a picture of David as a crazy man with drool in his beard and stuff like that? No, I tell you, I don't think there's anything out there. So, but I did get an email from Bob because I had mentioned the whole Sabbath day thing, and he sent me a thing that there's a whole grid over the entire city of Los Angeles. And you can go online, and that way you can travel on the Sabbath, because there's these lines connecting from the temple all over. It's called the Erev grid. And so you can check. So you can travel on the Sabbath and break that law just because there's strings all over Los Angeles. Very fascinating. If a string is broken, that means the grid might be compromised. You should just then go ahead and stay home and honor the Sabbath and not actually go anywhere. So. Yes, it extends the boundary of the temple and of your house, and in doing that, you're able to travel, because you're only allowed to travel from your house to the temple. But if the temple is essentially connected by lines everywhere, then you're all good. So, but anyway, David acts like a crazy man, but then he takes off. He leaves Gath. I think he's learned his lesson, especially based on one of the Psalms that is read. 1 Samuel chapter 22. David left Gath and encamped in the cave of Adullam. If you go online, you can see lots of pictures of the cave of Adullam. The problem is they don't know which cave is the correct cave. I saw at least a dozen different caves claiming to be the cave that David hid out in. I don't think we'll ever really know what's going to happen there. And while he's there, this is one of those instances, as I said, that you get the feeling that David is in a cave, literally and metaphorically. Spiritually, he's not in a very good position. David is one of those people that probably comes close to being a manic depressive. You'll read that throughout the Psalms. He'll spend part of the Psalm praising God and trusting in Him, and then the next moment going, everyone's going to kill me, I'm going to die, I'm surely gonna fail in this life. And he goes back and forth, but as you start reading it, you start realizing, man, this dude's a regular guy like us. Cause I don't know about you, but, you know, it's not all sunshines and roses, right? I mean, we don't just eat rainbows and poop butterflies, do we? There's bad stuff that can, what was that from? That was, Horton Hears a Who. That was my quote there. Things are not always going well, and David ends up in a cave, and he actually writes a couple of psalms. Now, we don't know if these are the exact psalms written from this exact cave, because David actually ends up in lots of different caves. So we got to take a peek at a couple of them. Flip forward to me with Psalm 142. Psalm 142. Yeah. As we were actually thinking about it a little bit later on. Someone like leaves really quickly and has to go find David, and they're like, "Well, how did they find David? I mean, is like I think there's a big sign over the cave. You know, David's secret hideout is you know right here." Yeah. So if they only had signs, that would be a really great thing. Psalm 142. You'll see the heading there. It says a maskil of David when he was in the cave, which, I don't know, again, metaphorically, isn't that great? If you're ever like, I'm in a cave, I'm just in a place that's dark and dank and stinky and the world is falling apart all around me and I'm sitting here in this cave, this might not be a bad psalm to go to. A cry aloud to the Lord. I lift up my voice to the Lord for mercy. I pour out my complaint before him. Before him, I tell my trouble. When my spirit grows faint within me, it is you who know my way. And that's David, that's why we think this is the one, because he's going to spend some time and he's actually going to admit, I know God's with me. The problem is I just don't know what God's going to do. And again, you can act very spiritual in a way where you say, you know what, I know God's going to do this, 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 and this in my life. And especially when things are bad, sometimes we say, gosh, shouldn't we show some spiritual bravado and say everything's going to be fine? Or does it take actually a very spiritually mature and strong person to say, you know what, I know God's in control, but I really just don't know how things are going to shake out. Things are so tentative, so tenuous, so strenuous, so crazy. I know God's here, but I just don't know what the next step is. We often take that as a sign of spiritual weakness, but I don't think it is. I think David admits it. He admits it here that, God, I don't know the way. I'm faint, but you know what? You know the way. You know the steps I'm going to take, and I pray, Lord, direct my path, direct my steps. I think that's a great way to actually act. In the path where I walk, men have hidden a snare for me. Verse 4, look to my right and see no one is concerned for me. I have no refuge. No one cares for my life. Do you ever feel like that? Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I guess I'll go eat some worms. It's interesting because this is a strange contrast because Saul and David actually suffer from the same problem. We're going to read in a little while, Saul's going to be saying the exact same thing. But there's a vast difference between the two. David, I think, is just at the end of his rope. Like, I'm dead. There's no hope for me. I'm running for my life. He holds all the cards. He has all the chips. He has all the weapons. He has all the military. He has all the power. I've got nothing. And that's why he wonders, you know, this thing is just doomed. And you can actually have those thoughts and still be a Christian. Isn't that good news? You don't always have to be saying, you know what, everything's just going to be fine and dandy, because sometimes it just isn't. And David admits that. Verse 5, I cry to you, O Lord, I say you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Listen to my cry, for I am in desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they are too strong for me. Set me free from my prison. You get that feeling that he's trapped in a cave? It's a great place to be, that I may praise your name, and the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness in me. Flip backwards to Psalm 57. Psalm 57. This one, we really do think that it's... the Psalms are not written chronologically, but it is kind of interesting that Psalm 56 corresponds with the previous chapter in 1 Samuel when he was in Philistia, captured by the Philistines, and he was there praying. Psalm 50, and then the next Psalm, Psalm 57, he's in a cave. So this seems pretty close, though we do find David in caves a lot. This one's probably this exact time. Have mercy on me, O God, have mercy on me, for in you my soul takes refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. Isn't that an interesting way to pray? Because oftentimes, I know you and I, what would we rather pray? Get me out of the disaster, or take the disaster away. But how often does God actually, instead of taking the disaster away, just give you the strength and the ability to weather those disasters? it's an interesting thing, and I think that it strengthens us. We'll stop there with Psalm 57. Let's flip backwards to 1 Samuel 22 and actually continue with verse 1, because I know we're getting really far here. So he's in the cave. You get the sense that he's kind of depressed. He's unsure. He doesn't know where to go or what to do. But it's interesting because he's joined by some people there, the second half of verse 1. When his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. Well, how did they know? This is the big neon signs out here. And I don't know, I find it interesting that the father and the brothers are there. Now, I understand, you know, Saul is on this paranoia kick right now, and he believes that everyone's out to get him. And so I really think that his family, David's family, is in really serious jeopardy. Saul has no problem with wanting to kill his own kid. I think the only reason why Jonathan is alive is because Saul, I think, wants to use Jonathan to try and get close back to Saul, because otherwise I think he'd be dead. He's going to go after the family. So the brothers and the father show up, but I don't know, is that good news for David or not? I mean, this is the same family that, you remember the father, Samuel shows up, I'm going to anoint one of your kids as king. Do you have any kids, any sons here? And he goes, yeah, I got 7 of them. But he actually had 8. And he grabs the 7 kids, puts them in front of Samuel, and Samuel goes, no, not one of these. Is this all you got? And they go, well, there is another kid. Oh, it's David. He's, I don't know if he really counts as a kid. They brought him in. That's it. You know, when that, thanks, Dad. Thanks for the vote of confidence there. I really appreciate that. And then his brothers, you know, his oldest brother called him a snotty-nosed, bratty thrill seeker. And so they're now in the, maybe that's why he wrote the Lord, I am in such depression. I got my family here with me. Verse 2, check out who else shows up. All those who are in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their leader. About 400 men were with him. This is the David's tea party. You know, all the disgruntled with the government people all show up. Yeah, what a ragtag. Now, and again, it doesn't say what was that? Yeah. Robin Hood and his merry men. Yeah, they talk about a ragtag crew. And it is interesting. We don't know what David thought about it. If you're the commander of the royal bodyguard, you're commander of armies within the palace, and the next thing you know, you're in a cave and you've got, you know, Manny, Moe, and Jack saying, yeah, fight the man. We're with you, David. You're like, you can't fight anything. You got nothing. But that's who's with them. It's interesting that some pastor posited this. I thought it was an interesting idea. If David could lead these guys, then he could pretty much lead anybody. If you can, you know, lead a bunch of disgruntled, upset, cantankerous people. I mean, I do this every single week. I'm just kidding. No, totally kidding. I was about to say it almost every single day with the family there. So, yes, Rich. Oh, yeah. It's like Jesus with his disciples. You know, if you could take these 12 yokels and actually do something well with them, you know, hey, then he can be my God too. And you're not so far gone. David's got this group of people. I think it's a very interesting thing. You know, the thing that's going to help out, what would David's life had actually been like if he had gone from being in the royal palace, commanding the royal army, and then just stepping right into the throne? Would he have any connection whatsoever to the regular folk? And I think that's what we see here with him leading these people. He's no longer in the palace. He's no longer eating royal food. He has no royal money. He just has to lead these people who are all disgruntled and upset and in debt and saying, I'll follow you. So David, you know, again, some great leadership here where he's able to take care of these guys. And there's about 400 guys with him in that cave. Kind of crazy. It's a big cave. It is. Actually, later on, he gets into another cave and he's got 600. So, it's, yeah, isn't that a great, yeah, he's in hiding. Yeah. It's like playing sardines. Isn't that a great, do you remember that? Y'all go hide and seek, and the person that, and then if someone finds you, they have to hide with you. And soon you got like 12 people and the last person. It's pretty obvious. Don't you see the 12 feet sticking out from under the table? You know, it's pretty easy to spot him. Yeah. David's in hiding and he can't, yeah. Yeah, go away. I'm in hiding. You're gonna, But at least he's gathering a rebellion. You know, we got the little Luke Skywalker stuff going on here. Yeah, I'm going to need a bigger cave. Yeah. Verse 3. From there... Moving on. From there, David went to Mizpah and Moab and said to the king of Moab, "Would you let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?" Until I learn what God will do for me. Again, there's no false piety going, you know what? This will all be over soon. Everything's going to be fine. He literally said, I'm not quite too sure what's going to happen next. This is David, Mr. Psalms, Mr. You read his stuff and you go, I wish I had a faith like him. But here he is at a point when he goes, I don't know what to do next. And there's nothing wrong with that. Some people say he went to Moab because his grandmother was from there. Whether that's his motivation or not, I don't know. His grandmother Ruth was a Moabitess. So maybe thinking that they'll be safe there. A lot of people spilled a lot of ink on that. And well, okay, or he was just trying to find a safe place for his family. Verse 4, so he left him with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. So now it's turned from a cave. It's more now like the Bat Cave. It's, you know, it's a stronghold. He's fortifying. That's a good place to be. Have you ever been in a position where kind of the world is crashing around you? And I know what we all kind of do. We all jump into a cave and we say to ourselves, if I can at least just manage the cave, if I can fortify the cave, if I can protect myself here, then I'm going to be okay. And I think that it's just a natural instinct that all of us have, because that is a safe place to be. If you got a cave, you got one opening, you can defend one opening. And that's something that I think all of us really crave, especially when things are going bad. Can we just have a sense of security? Just a sense of normalcy in this whole thing. And you would think that maybe that's where David should stay. Maybe David should stay in the cave. Maybe David should just fortify that and he'll feel secure. But that's not what happens at all. Verse 5, a prophet is there with him too. The prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Go into the land of Judah." So David left and went into the forest of Herith. So again, David is not without his connection with God. He himself is at a point that he is so uncertain of how things are going to shake out that he seeks other advice, that he seeks other wisdom. And that's what Gad is. And Gad actually is one of David's. David actually has three prophets that he leans on. And it's spelled out if you want it. It's 1 Chronicles 29:29 actually lists the three prophets. Oh, let's give bonus points if you can name them all. First prophet should be easy because we are in the book of 1 Samuel. Okay, so we got Samuel the prophet. Then there was another prophet that rebuked him with the whole David and Bathsheba issue. Nathan the prophet. And then we got Gad. And he's the one. Gad got the real bad end of the stick. Nathan, I'm sure it was bad going and confronting David after the Bathsheba incident, but there was another incident far worse where David takes a census of his fighting men, and God had said, "Don't ever." You know, let's take a look at it. Let's flip forward. It is 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel, what? It's near the end. 24. 2 Samuel 24. It is this little interesting story. I'm going to start at verse 9. Because David counts the men. Again, one of the things that God tells the kings is don't ever count your fighting men. Don't ever count your army. And the reason why is because if there's too few of them, you might say to yourself, I need to build up the army because I need the army to protect myself. And you start relying on the army so much that you don't actually need God anymore. We're going to go into a battle and we've got plenty of people here. We could fight this battle all on our own, as opposed to turning back to God and saying, please help. Same thing if you have so many, you might start getting a little cocky going, well, hey, look at me, I'm protected, I'm safe, I have no problems, instead of constantly crying out to God. So God knew the heart of man and said, whatever you do, don't ever count your fighting men. And check out what happens. Verse 9, he does. Joab reported the number of fighting men to the king. In Israel, there are 800,000 able-bodied men who can handle a sword, and in Judah, 500,000. Nice. 1.3 million people in the army. That's a pretty nice sized army. Check out the next verse. David was conscience stricken after he had counted the fighting men, and he said to the Lord, I've sinned greatly in what I've done. Now, O Lord, I beg you, take away the guilt of your servant. I've done a very foolish thing. And this is one of those unfortunate things where God often grants forgiveness, but sometimes still allows consequences to take place. Before David got up the next morning, the word of the Lord had come to Gad, the prophet, David's seer. Go and tell David, this is what the Lord says. I'm giving you three options. Choose one of them for me to carry out against you. So Gad went to David and said to him, shall there come upon you 3 years of famine in your land, or 3 months of fleeing from your enemies while they pursue you, or 3 days of plague? Yeah, how do you like that choice? 3 days of plague. Yeah, you would choose the three days of plague? It seems the shortest. And David actually says, you know what, that whole running in a cave for 3 months and being pursued? No, thank you. I mean, he actually says this. David said to Gad, I am in deep distress. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but do not let me fall into the hands of men. So please, yeah, I can't take that one option. So he chooses the 3 days of the plague. So the Lord sent a plague on Israel from that morning until the end of the time designated, and 70,000 people from Dan to Beersheba died. The David and Bathsheba incident did cause some death. This one caused 70,000 people to die. Wow. When the angel stretched out his hand to destroy Jerusalem, the Lord was grieved because of the calamity and said to the angel who was afflicting the people, enough, withdraw your hand. The angel of the Lord was then at the threshing floor of Arunah, the Jebusite. And this is a freaky verse. When David saw the angel who was striking down the people, how'd you like that? How'd you like that for a gift? Because I don't know if anyone else saw it. You know, there's David saying, do you guys see the angel there? Yeah, he's killing everyone. You guys don't see it, do you? You don't see that angel? Great. I'm going crazy here. There's it. Yep. You're about to die. See? Yeah. Bye. Yep. Yep. And it's all because of my choice. It was my, that would talk about a punishment. Whew. Sweet niblets. So, David learns a very valuable lesson. I guess that's also good for us. David makes mistakes, like all of us. Back in 1 Samuel. So that was probably way too much information on the prophet Gad. Gad. Yeah, Gadzooks. I'm sure that's where it came from. Or this is the New York way of saying God or something like that. Gad. Oh, my Gad. Can I say that? Verse 6. Now, I'm sorry, this is going to be a very depressing chapter. Yep. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered. Sweet! We know where they're at. The sign has been discovered. And Saul, isn't that nice? That's right. Spear in hand. I mean, the dude, if I was a servant of Saul, I don't think I would ever turn my back on that dude. It's like, you're going to throw something at a moment's notice, and I think I don't want to be anywhere near you. So, yeah. Saul, spear in hand, was seated under the tamarisk tree on the hill of Gibeah with all his officials standing around him. Saul said to them, listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Do you get what he's saying there? Hey, you want to bet on a winning horse, baby. You go with David, you're probably going to die. Me? I'll take care of you. You need some vineyards? You need some kickbacks here? You want me to give you a higher ranking in the Senate? Yeah, I can handle that for you. I'll boost you up a little bit. David's not going to be able to do that for you. So we find a little bit with Saul that he leads through intimidation, through anger, and also through bribery. That's fabulous. Go Saul. Is that why? And then check this out. At the very same breath, you kind of, again, you get that paranoia coming through. Is that why you have all conspired against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today. You get the thing that Saul is very, very lonely. Just like David, both trapped in a cave, one literally and one more in a prison of his own making in his mind, thinking that when things go bad, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes we go down a path that everything is bad and everything is wrong. Saul has some real serious issues, but here we get the reintroduction of Doeg. Remember him? He was detained before the Lord. Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provision in the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Was that true? Yeah, it was. Have you ever been able to tell the truth and yet it still is kind of a lie? You ever been able to do that? Because what is Doeg essentially saying? He is essentially inferring that Ahimelech is conspiring against you as well. You know what I saw, David? He was down there with Ahimelech. You know what he gave him? He gave him food. He gave him a sword. He gave him Goliath's sword. And Ahimelech also inquired of the Lord for David. Yeah. What would you infer if you were Saul at that point? That Ahimelech's in on the conspiracy. I mean, it doesn't take much for a conspiracy theorist to see something and all of a sudden jump on that bandwagon whole hog. And so Doeg is feeding into Saul's paranoia, and this is not going to be good then. Verse 11, then the king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and his father's whole family who were the priests at Nob, and they all came to the king. Saul said, listen now, son of Ahitub. Yes, my lord, he answered. Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today? How do you like that? How would you feel right now if you're Ahimelech? I'm in deep doo-doo. Because first of all, did Ahimelech have any idea that Jesse was a rebel, or that David was a rebel and was leaving? No, he was. Yeah, Ahimelech was told, "I'm on a, he was on a secret mission. He said he needed some food. He forgot his sword." And that's exactly, check out Ahimelech's response. That's exactly what he says. He says, Ahimelech answered the king, "Who of all your servants is as loyal as David? He is a king's son-in-law, a captain of your bodyguard, and highly respected in your household. Was that day the first time I inquired of God for him?" He's like, David's come to me a ton of times and asked for stuff, and I've always given it to him. This is no secret, no surprise. I'm not leading rebellion. He came down, asked for stuff, I gave it to him. Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant of any of his father's family, for the servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair. What are you talking about? He's in rebellion. I thought he was your son-in-law. What's going on here? But the king said, you will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family. Then the king ordered the guards at his side, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me. How would you like that? Now, what would you do? You're now standing by Saul. He's just accused this guy of treason. He says, I have no idea what you're talking about. And the king tells you, kill the pastor. Yeah, no, don't kill the pastor. Don't, please don't kill the pastor. What would you do? Just out of curiosity. Come on, give the noble answer. It's my job. It's my job. I have to kill the pastor. Yeah, all of us would say, no way. There is one thing that I have to admit that is kind of nice being a pastor, that now and again I do actually get a couple perks that otherwise I think, which is really sad. People still look at pastors and think that there's something like extra holy about me, and don't ever do anything bad against a pastor, because that, you know, don't steal from a pastor. You know, yeah, you better remember this. Okay, yeah, you. it's true. When I was in seminary, I think I've told this, but I'm not too sure. I had to do a stint in East St. Louis. And East St. Louis is the equivalent of East L.A. They say if your tire goes flat in East St. Louis, drive on the rims. You just keep going. Don't ever stop your car, because it's a bad place. So I'm going into East St. Louis, and they're like, you really need to buy a clerical collar. And wear it. Now, have you guys even seen me in a clerical collar? I should wear one just for the fun. I should wear one just for the fun of it to see what you guys would do. It'd freak you guys out. But I said, I don't like to wear the clerical. I don't need that to tell me I'm a pastor. And they said, listen here, white boy. You are going in an area, and if you don't have a clerical on, they will shoot you. I said, I think I'm a 17 and a half, 34, 35. Where's my... And I went down there, and I did some prison stuff. I walked down the thing, and they said, wear your clerical for that. So I did, and sure enough, I'm walking down, and everyone's, hey, father, come here, father, come over here. And they actually rarely cussed in front of me. I mean, it still affords me, even At the hospital, I can sneak in saying I'm clergy. I think the nurses don't believe me, though. One nurse shot me this dirty look. She did. Well, because I had gone in earlier with Heather, and they're like, yeah, this is Heather and Mark. I'm the husband of, I'm the son-in-law. And so I come in the next time, but she's in critical condition, so they're not letting any family can only come in 10 minutes for each hour, but they'll allow clergy in any time because we still get a little extra perk. So I'm like, clergy to see Nancy Knox, and I walk in, and there's the nurse kind of looking at me. And I'm like, I'm clergy, lady, back off. And they're like, you're not the clergy who was here this morning. I said, no, that was Pastor Eric, and I'm Pastor Mark, and over here is another pastor. And we're all here. I'm a son-in-law, too. I'm not a liar. I promise. So, I should carry my collar in the car. Yeah, if I get pulled over or something like that. Would that get me anywhere? No. I'm looking at, yeah. Yeah. I did do it one time where I went in to get my oil changed, and they asked about the truck, and they said, what does SRCHLYT stand for? I said, that's Searchlight. I'm a pastor of a church. And the guy looked at me and goes, I've never seen a pastor dress like you. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, don't you always wear robes? No, I don't know. I never wear robes myself, but I guarantee your pastor doesn't wear robes every day either. Yeah, just really weird. Okay. Yeah, the robes, and it's like I'm wearing a dress, and the wind blows, and I'm like, keep my robe down. Yeah. What was that? Yeah, I can't find pumps that match my robe. It's just, it never works. Do you? Yeah, you know, when you're like us, yeah. So the king's officials, check out, I love this. So we're in the middle of verse 17, but the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Oh, praise God. We have some people in Saul's camp that have some shred of decency going, I don't think it's a good idea that we should just be killing pastors. Yeah, and that's a good, healthy thing. It's better to be more afraid of God than to being afraid of what Saul would do to you. Then the king ordered Doeg, you turn and strike down the priests. Now, Doeg was just a shepherd. And he wasn't part of the king's official crew. So what would be the fastest way to climb up the corporate ladder? I could be the king's hitman. I could be his muscle. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. Not one pastor, not five pastors. 85 pastors. Well, as a pastor, we usually don't carry swords with us. So, at that point, it would also be one of those things like, with 85, they're not going to catch us all, dude. Let's just run. And sure enough, one actually does run in just a little bit. But, you know, they were all summoned there so they're thinking the king wants us. Maybe he needs some spiritual advice or something. And next thing you know, you're surrounded and this guy's just hacking through. And you're defenseless. You have nothing. So you'd think, but let's say, you know, yeah, one at a time. Like, okay, we're going to speak to you, Pat. We need to corroborate the story. Come with me. And boom, he's dead. And it's very. Yeah, yeah. This is one of those things where I don't know. Is there a special place in hell for Doeg? I don't know. Maybe I take it personally because I'm a pastor. Now, check this out. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and its infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. So don't believe for one moment that 1 Samuel 15 thing when God had ordered the destruction of the Amalekites and Saul said, I just don't think I could do it. No, Saul's lying. Saul won't raise a hand against his enemies, but he's quite adept at killing his own people and slaughtering an entire town because of this one person. I don't know. I mean, this is Saul's going downhill, and he's going down. I mean, he's killing. And how'd you like that? Going into an entire town and just killing people because one person, a priest there, did something you didn't like. I don't like it. Someone escapes. Yeah, he is sending a message. You know, don't mess with Saul. Don't cross me. Don't. And this would be an interesting thing, because if you're with Saul at this point, you do need to wonder, when do I need to jump ship? You jump ship too soon, I could be hunted down. Jump ship too late, David will get me. And where's my loyalty, though? This is one of the questions that you have to be asking yourself, I think, all the time, is who do you want to follow? Do you follow the right path, even though it's the hard path, or the wrong path, even though it's the easy path? I don't know about you. I think I could probably track through my life with any decision that I've ever made and come to a conclusion. It's got to be up there, 95. I think it's 100%. That any time I've had to make a choice, the right choice has always been the hard choice. Is that, I don't know, what is that happening in your life, Lynn? That's how, anytime you got choices and you're like, if I do this, I know that this is the right thing that I should be doing, but to do that, it's going to be so hard. My life's going to be turned upside down. I might have to sacrifice a lot, but I know that this is the right thing to do. But I look at this choice over here, and it's real easy. I mean, it's even fun. This would be a great thing to do. And I say, why don't I just do that? But you look at it and you go, but it's the wrong choice. And we sometimes fool ourselves into saying, well, I'll take the maybe, you know what, maybe God is making this path easy for me over here, and that's what he would want me to do. It's when you got to stop and you go, oh, who am I following? Do I follow the easy choice or the hard choice? I'll just go out on record saying, if you ever get faced with a decision and one's easy and one's hard, just choose hard. That'd be a great slogan. Can we put that on tennis shoes? Choose hard. I mean, you've got to realize that that's how it often works with us. And it's difficult to follow God sometimes. I'm not going to say it's easy. It's hard. But if it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do. And that's most important. Abiathar escapes, verse 20. But Abiathar, a son of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, escaped and fled to join David. How would you feel if you were Abiathar heading to go see David? Yeah, I hope no one's following you. How would you feel against David? Would you be mad? Yeah, because we do that. We're like, wasn't David responsible for this whole thing? We kind of think that, but it's not quite right, is it? Was David responsible for the killing of the priests at Nob? No, Saul was. Saul was. But I know that that's how sometimes I am. I remember reading about an accident where cars were up there and someone was coming along. Two cars, they were going pretty fast. Car in front sees the accident, doesn't hit its brakes and doesn't hit the car, but instead swerves out of the way. And car behind, boom, right in. So you know what car number two did? Sued car number one. Because if you would have crashed into it or slowed down, I wouldn't have actually crashed. Well, why don't you just slow down? Did car number one actually cause your accident, or was it your stupidity because you're driving so stinking fast? But that's what we do. Instead of actually laying blame where blame is supposed to be laid, we try and deflect that all the time. I mean, I hear it all the time with kids and their parents. Oh, I'm the way I am because my parents raised me this way and it's all their fault. Well, you know what? You can blame your parents for a lot. I really think that, but then there comes a point when you just got to realize, no, you just did something really stupid, and that's your fault. And sooner or later, you got to take ownership of that and say, we could do the same thing with the government. Oh my gosh, the government's bad. You know, things are the way they are because of the government. You know what? I think all of us are quite good at being irresponsible, and collective irresponsibility causes lots of problems. I think it's time for all of us start to take ownership. Now, Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, very interesting. He actually doesn't blame David, because I was thinking, you know, you read the story, you're like, what's the first thing he's going to do? Walk in and give David a backhand right across the face. But he doesn't. Abiathar actually remains with David until even after David's death. David dies, and in 1 Kings chapter 2, Solomon replaces Abiathar the priest with Zadok. Abiathar had remained in David's service that whole time. Not once did he look at David and say, "You are responsible for the killing of my family." Instead, he laid blame exactly where it was, which is the bad person that did it all in the first place. I don't know, I guess that's why I'm jaded when I hear 911 conspiracy theories and stuff like that. The government caused all this. No, there was a couple guys that were really crazy and wanted to kill a lot of people. And if I'm going to lay any blame on anybody, that's where I'm laying my blame. Because they're responsible. It was their actions. And I won't take this whole thing of other things of... I'm moving on. Here we go. I don't take responsibility when it should be responsibility and stop blaming everyone else for your problems. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And how would you feel at that point if you were David? I'd feel pretty terrible. Then David said to Abiathar that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, "I am responsible for the death of your father's whole family." Such a marked contrast to Saul, who probably told the families, "You brought this on yourself." As opposed to David that says, "Wow, my actions have major consequences." If we could teach our teenagers that would be great. Verse 23. She's not talking about you, Becca. Don't worry. She's talking about Brandon over here. "Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who is seeking your life is seeking mine also. You will be safe with me." We're seeing David at the lowest point, really, of his life. And I pray that this gives you comfort in the fact that even if we are in the cave, that God hears and knows. And even when you may not know what is going to happen next, God does. And there's evil around us, my friends. There are lots of Doegs and lots of Sauls. The question is, who do we align ourselves with? Let's pray. Father, I pray for your mercy, as many of us have made choices that are bad, and we've some of our caves that we have gotten into are self-inflicted. But we pray, Lord, that even when we are down and depressed and feeling that everything's falling apart around us, that we would still be able to cry out and say, "Lord, please hear our prayer. Lord, please hear our cry. Come with your mercy. Come with your great arms. Surround us with your love." And as we look to the future, may we always know that you are with us every step of the way, even when we don't feel it, even when we can't understand it. We just wish to go into default mode and just say, "You're going to be with us." Thank you for that promise and your peace in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. God